First of all, I wanted to introduce the refuge, because not everybody's really familiar with the Maine Coastal Island National Wildlife Refuge. The map over here does show all of our islands. The refuge consists of about 8,000 acres that are in 50 islands and four mainland units. The four mainland units are about half of our acreage here in the Millbridge area. And then we have islands all the way from Isle of Shoals, almost in New Hampshire, to more or less in Canada, Machias Seal Island being one of ours. And so the refuge, as you can see, is quite spread out. We have a staff of 8 people. We have 2 offices, and the reason we have 2 offices is the main management function, or the thing that we concentrate on, is seabird restoration. And out of those 50 islands, there's only 6 where we have active restoration projects. You've probably all heard of Project Puffin. Mm-hmm. And between, you know, the National Audubon that runs Project Puffin is one of our very close partners, along with the Maine Department of Inland Fisheries and Wildlife. And so those 3 partners are the major partners that work on these seabird islands. So there's a total of 11 managed islands between those 3 partners. And what management means in seabird restoration is that these terns and puffins and things are nesting on the same islands with the big gulls, with the laughing gulls and the herring gulls. Now, herring gulls nest on unmanaged, you know, gulls nest on unmanaged islands and do fine as well, and cormorants. But terns cannot really withstand the pressure from the gulls. And so we almost lost them from the state. I mean, all these birds were almost lost. At the turn of the century, they came back, you know, when the hunting laws were, market hunting and women's hats and things, the laws were passed to regulate take. And so they all came back, but then the gulls had a bit of a help from us. You know, they're omnivores. In the winter, they were at open dumps and whatnot. So their population grew a little faster. They get there first for nesting, and they sort of push the seabirds out and eat eggs and chicks whenever the seabirds are disturbed. And so it takes human presence out there. They did actually quite well into the, you know, the terns hung on until the Coast Guard automated the lights. And when the lighthouse keepers left, they used to harass the gulls away because they didn't want the gulls in their water, you know, supply on the roof. Water from the roof going into the cistern, so they didn't want the row of gulls up there pooping in their water. So, but when they left, when the Coast Guard pulled out in the late 70s, we almost lost all the terns again. And so what we do is we have crews of student researchers that we put out there in the middle of May, and they stay there till the middle of August. And they basically, they're there early, they harass the gulls with fireworks and, you know, human presence chasing and that kind of thing. So that means that we have students out there all summer. We have to provide them with water on a regular basis and food and that kind of thing. So we have regular runs out to all these islands. So that's a long way of saying we need 2 offices. One is in Rockport, where we have 3 employees. We run boats out of Rockland, and they service Matinic Island, Matinicus Rock, and Seal, which are all right here. Seal being, you know, these are pretty far offshore, so even from Rockland it takes about an hour and a half or an hour and 45 minutes to get to those 2, and Pond Island in Bath. So we trailer our boats. We have 1 boat and 2 operators there. We have 2 boats and 1 operator in Millbridge, and they service Petiminan Island, where we have an active colony, or an active restoration project with students, and also Eastern Brothers, which is over here by Roke Island, off Roke Island. So there's you know, we're very busy with just 8 employees servicing all these students. And, you know, some years, like this year, we're doing a second field season. We just put students out on 3 islands that will be doing intensive monitoring of shorebirds during the fall migration and also passerine, you know, migration songbirds. And so they're banding, and, you know, so now we'll have students out there for another 2 months. So we're very busy with that, and that's just a way of explaining kind of where we are geographically and that kind of thing. And the reason I bring that up is most people, a lot of people, you know, have never heard of us, don't know we exist. They don't, even when they see me in Rockland in my uniform, you know, there's no recognition really of who we are. And that's kind of, the Fish and Wildlife Service has always had an identity problem, you know, the Park Service being much, much better known than we are. But we're all often confused with the state Fish and Wildlife agencies, and that's understandable because they probably have ducks on their uniforms too. And But the difference, of course, is that we do migratory birds and the state agencies do resident species. So we're doing the terns that are long-distance migrants. The state certainly does it, too, in the case of terns being, you know, state-listed, in some cases, some species of terns being state-listed, et cetera. So there's some overlap. We certainly cooperate, but we don't do deer, we don't do moose, we don't do turkeys, we don't do trout, we do salmon. So that's the difference. And one of the things, you know, so we're a little-known agency, and we're also a very little-known refuge, because most refuges have a large land, you know, like Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge. You go to Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge, it's 20,000 acres, whatever it is. You know, you drive down the road, there's a big sign, there's a visitor center, or, you know, a visitor, an office, a headquarters. Most refuges have some kind of a visitor contact station, and people come to it to get oriented, and then they go out on trails, et cetera, et cetera. We do have some trails. Some people do know the trails in Millbridge and come into the office in Millbridge. But generally, when we did our comprehensive conservation plan, that plans for 15 years out, you know, it's pretty obvious need that our refuge needs some kind of a visitor contact center so that people know we exist. Since most of our islands are closed, you know, we have a lot of land that people can't go on because they can't, you know, we can't have them disturbing these colonial nesting seabirds that nest on the ground and are very damaged by disturbance. You know, if you walk through a colony, they all go up and the gulls come in and clean them out. So a lot of our islands are closed for most of the summer. And the only way people get to know us really is through some of the tour boats. And frankly, the tour boats don't always know that this is a national wildlife refuge. There's some signage, some sort of international seabird signage that we've switched to. Some of our islands have brown signs, but they're very hard to read from any distance. And so we're very little known and would like to have a much higher profile so that people know we exist. So that gets me to the part about what we're doing now. What we've done now is because the Comprehensive Conservation Plan said, you know, why don't you build a visitor center? Why don't you build it between, you know, in the mid-coast area between Damariscotta and Sears Island, instead of up here where we get, as you know, tourism pretty much drops off past Acadia, so we don't get the numbers of visitors up there that we would down here. And so whenever a federal agency does a major action, it needs to comply with the National Environmental Policy Act, which is just basically common sense that you should look at all the alternatives and consider cost, impact, etc. So we did that. We went out and looked at all these different alternatives and wrote this draft environmental assessment, which I don't know if you guys have read it yet or not.
Have you all read it?
So basically, the purpose and need for action, I've pretty well covered that, I think. I'm just going to kind of go through. Here's the map that shows that area that we were asked to place the center in, so we picked some alternatives there. And then on page 1 and 2, these are taken right from the CCP. The criteria that were in the CCP that I tried to use, some of these criteria, there was very little difference. For example, good access to emergency services. You know, I didn't pick any sites that had bad access. So a lot of them I didn't go on to rank. The ones where I didn't think it was a real big deal, you know, that all of them were kind of in that cluster of sameness or acceptability, I didn't rank them all. So I ended up with 9 different criteria that are derived from these criteria that were right in the comprehensive plan. So then Chapter 2 talks about alternatives, and that's mostly what I thought I would do tonight, is just show you real quickly what the alternatives were and go real quickly over the ranking of the criteria and then, you know, open it up to questions. We always have to have a no-action alternative, and in this case, that would be remaining in our leased space. One of the important notes is that not only do we need a visitor center, but both of our offices are in leased space, and leased space is very expensive. The Fish and Wildlife Service, being the sort of underfunded agency it is, wants to save money, and so we are trying to move, just as a a policy in this region to try and move into service-owned facilities because they tend to be cheaper. Probably, I'm paying, I think, $41,000 a year for my office as a lease. You know, and the energy costs for all of these would be, you know, 23 or something. So we would save quite a bit of money. So there's always that no action alternative. The no action alternative would be to either stay in our existing lease space or move into some other lease space. And there would be no visitor center built. We just kind of keep doing what we're doing. Alternative B is in Damariscotta, and the folks at the Damariscotta River Association own what used to be Round Top Farm. And for a while it was the Round Top Center for Arts. And then I guess that sort of went belly up and they sort of inherited this site. The restrictions on the donation of that site to the Damariscotta River Association make it so they can't resell it. So we cannot own that site. Which in and of itself, if I was being very strict in the criteria that were laid forth in the CCP, would eliminate that site. Because one of the criteria was that the service could own it in fee, which means that you own the whole site. But I think it's, you know, in some ways a viable alternative, so I put it in there. You know, I've talked to them at length. It's quite a nice spot. It's got about an 1850s farmhouse. That has sufficient, it has gallery space that would be, you know, you could convert it to exhibits. The farmhouse itself has smaller rooms that would be good offices. There's plenty of boat storage there. Unfortunately, you know, if we stored boats there, we would have to trailer them quite a distance to get to Rockland where we like to launch. And so it's
there's
a kind
of... Oysterbiddens around there too?
There are. There's none right on, you know, we would just be moving into the building. So we wouldn't really be affecting, you know, we wouldn't be excavating or building a new building there. So we would be retrofitting the existing building. The building would need work. It needs insulation. It needs a new roof. It would need to be made universally accessible, which it is not right now. So there's a lot of sort of work that would be required to retrofit that building. But it would be, you know, doable. It's a nice spot. It's very farm-like. You know, you're looking at some salt water, but it feels like you're on a river rather than, because you're fairly high up the river. Here's the town of Damariscotta, and here's the site itself. So the river, you know, this is Great Salt Bay. But it doesn't give you that kind of island feeling we were hoping for, because we do want to evoke kind of the offshore site. The old county road in Rockport came up because this was donated to our friends group. We have a friends group, the Friends of Maine Seabird Islands, and there's an elderly gentleman with no family was looking to preserve this piece of land. A lot of the land trust didn't really want it because it's not, you know, adjacent to any other protected land. But we saw a lot of potential there in the sense that it could be a visitor center or could help us be a place to put our boats. So they're holding this property right now. I'm sorry these are so small. You know, I didn't know. I was going to put them around the room and have people walk around and look, but this room has a lot of stuff on the walls. But this is the Home Depot in Rockland, if you're familiar with that site. Just a place where it is. And kind of there's the sports bar.
Yeah.
Below. So it's right sort of above the sports bar on this road, which as you... If you're from that area, you know this road is much higher elevation. There's a big ledge there. And that has a couple implications. One of which is I think the ledge would be really... My engineers are like, well, we could build something there. Like, I'm not so sure. You know, that you wouldn't be really blasting a lot of stuff and it would be very expensive.
So is that overlooking the bay? I'm trying to imagine.
It would from the back of the property. Yeah, there's the property is pretty flat and then there's this steep kind of drop. And so what's happened over time is this has grown up, but the person that donated to us said that, you know, when he first had the property back in probably the 40s or 50s, there was a fabulous view. So I think if you cleared some trees, you would have that view. So we looked at this as if it were a viable site. I have some concerns about the ledge and about the size of the lot and things like that. We tend to put standard design buildings on that would look like this. So just, you know, it might be a different color, slightly different, but, you know, we have a standard design. That's kind of what it would look like, and it would cost quite a bit of money, $4 million or so to build that building. So, and when I was struggling with this problem of where do I put my boats, which was, I think, underestimated in the comprehensive plan, you know, it came to me that I needed to go out of Rockland Harbor no matter where the visitor center was, you know, because it just doesn't make sense to add an hour. You know, if I came up to Sears Island, for example, you add an hour to your day on each end, so that's 2 hours. When it's an hour and a half to get out to one of these islands after you launch, that's 3 hours, you know, there and back. So then you'd have 5 hours, and you'd have 3 hours of work time left, you know, basically. So we can't really afford the time to be sending people, you know, trailering boats or going down the river, which is even slower, or from either way. So we figured the efficient thing to do was just say, okay, we're going to keep our boats in Rockland no matter where we put the visitor center. So this site shows up as a component of almost all the other alternatives. Whether we put the visitor center here or not, our boats would be here under every alternative. Alternative D, which is our preferred alternative, as it turns out, because the criteria ranked it the highest, is in downtown Rockland. If you're familiar with downtown Rockland, Route 1 comes in here and takes a 90-degree turn right through the business district, the downtown business district, and there, if you go south on 73, just, you know, a quarter of a mile, couple blocks really, there's an old MBNA, or a building that used to belong to MBNA. It was MBNA's parking lot is over here, and that is now Boston Financial. This building was their child care center.
It's kind of like two buildings combined.
Yeah, these two buildings were historic, you know, kind of houses of some kind. And then what they did was they sort of gutted the inside, and they built this modern building in the middle in the same style as the old buildings. And the way this is laid out for us, you know, what is very attractive, because number one, they've gone in and done all the work. There's we would have to do a little bit of parking, some plumbing changes, because being a child care center, there's a lot of little toilets. And we thought our visitors probably would want them a little higher. So we'd have to change that. And some of the exhibit rooms on this side, these are big rooms, basically taking up the whole floor here. They have an internal structure, you know, some cabinets and internal walls that we would want to take out to as much as we could. But this is two big exhibit spaces. When you first walk in the door, there's a couple little offices, one on each side, and then this room here, which thoughtfully they did into seabird-type murals for us, so that's already even done. And then upstairs, there's some offices here, which would accommodate my staff in Rockport. And then over here, there's classrooms. So this building is already very well set up for our needs. And as you can see, it's done very well. It has all the automatic door openers, universal accessibility, et cetera, et cetera.
Some nice murals, it looks like.
Yeah, yeah, like I said, they're all islands and seabirds, and it's pretty nice. The next alternative, Lincolnville Beach. This one, again, we were just looking at what was on the market, you know, to compare it. I wanted to come to these meetings with kind of the whole gamut, so that people wouldn't be raising their hands and saying, well, why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that? So we looked at this one. It's, as you come, this is coming from the south to the north. Here's the ferry in Lincolnville Beach. Here's the beach up here. And right at the top of the hill, just before you go down to the ferry, on your right-hand side, there's a commercial building for sale. This building is an older one that was retrofitted. Again, could be offices. And this one is a big open space. So even though it's pretty small, you could certainly have, I think it's 2,600 square feet in two stories. You could do, you know, it's a big open exhibit area. And the downstairs could probably be turned into some classrooms. It's got like a walkout basement. So it's not as big as I would like, but, you know, it's perfectly viable, I think. And it's right on Route 1. I mean, you can't miss it. It's boom right there. And of course, there's always the option of just buying a parcel of land and building a building, which is frequently, you know, when we do something like this, these are usually on refuge-owned land. In this case, we bought this particular site that was adjacent to the refuge and overlooked the refuge and built the building there. There was actually a bar there that we were going to use until the roof collapsed. But, of course, there are not that many parcels. I just tried to get the best parcel that was on the market at the moment. I think it's been withdrawn from the market right now. Although, who knows, if you called up the realtor and said, you know, we want to buy it for your asking price, I'm sure you could buy it. But because the market was soft, they withdrew it. But the problem, of course, is that you add another $1 million onto your total tariff. So this is certainly the most expensive of the options. And alternative G was Sears Island. We had, you know, talked to different people and knew that this was an option. This is we can't own it in fee because the Department of Transportation owns it. And but the conservation easement was recently placed on it with the intention of having some kind of visitor center there. And so the question was, you know, should it be our visitor center? The easement allowed for a visitor center to be determined of somebody else's, you know. And again, you know, we wouldn't have the expense of purchasing the land, but we would be, you know, clearing land and building a building. So those are pretty much the alternatives. Is everybody, any questions about those right now? You know, and then we could just go on to the criteria. Well, I'll just lead you through the next chapter, which is the affected environment. And this is the one where you try and describe, you know, we first describe the environment of the main coast just in general to, you know, to let people know kind of what's going on. And then you try and describe the environment of alternative sites to the best of your ability, and that's checking things like soils if you're going to have to do construction, septic tanks, you know, if you have a concern. And several of the sites are kind of limited. I would say all three of our building sites had some soil limitations that you have to worry about a little bit. In the way of ledge, mostly, I think. And in the case of Sears Island, there's some wetlands. And then we also looked at the flood hazard zones to make sure that none of these sites were inside of a 100-year flood zone. And that's all described in this chapter that goes on to about page 17. And then under environmental consequences, I mean, this is a pretty simple project as far as straight environmental consequences. As in, you know, I think a lot of the environmental impact statements where that's a really big thing would be, you know, an oil refinery or, I don't know, things that produce air pollution, et cetera, et cetera. In this case, you know, we're either building a building or retrofitting an existing building, so the development impacts are pretty straightforward. So one of the things that I tried to do in here was, you know, talk about the fit. How well did this building work for us? How much did it cost? What were those construction impacts? And a lot of those, again, are derived from the criteria. And then something that wasn't really in the criteria but I thought could be something that would help us think about which site was best was the effectiveness, so which one meets our objectives. And the objectives are in an appendix, but they basically have to do with, you know, how well can we educate local kids, how well can we reach tourists, how well can we be a part of the community, and those kinds of things. And so the fit to basic site criteria on page 17, again, I tried to, these are basically all the bullets of things that didn't seem to be that different. You know, they were all they were all kind of in that acceptable ballpark for those things. And then I went through the effectiveness was choosing sort of criteria that would measure that. And again, we picked, I think, the number of school children within a 15-mile radius. The 15 miles had to do with the objectives that came from. Average daily number of cars had to do with how many tourists go by. So if you have The alternative sheet, I just made this as sort of a cheat sheet for people who really didn't want to read the whole thing. This is kind of the meat of how the sites differ from each other. So I can go through all those if you want. You know, proximity to Route 1, proximity to the ocean. So proximity to Route 1 is how visible is this site so that people will see it and go there? Or do I have to drag them sort of off of a major route? Proximity to the ocean is that island feel that we were talking about, trying to get people at least sort of in the frame of mind that, you know, this is a refuge about islands, so it's nice to get them sort of thinking that way when they walk in. The third one, central location for management of mid-coast operations, I've talked about that. You know, how close is it to our boat ramp? And that's important not just, you know, it's kind of important for two things. I mean, one is just the day-to-day operation. I can certainly put my staff over at Old County Road, but if some of them are over there and I'm an hour away, you all know that when you're all in the same office, you talk, you know, communication's just better. You know, there's no way around that. Readily available outdoor environment for programming. Damariscotta has a lot of trails on their site. Sears Island has some trails. So I rank them accordingly. And service owned, again, I said Damariscotta and Sears Island rank the lowest on that because we can't purchase those, which is kind of it's a really big problem to our lawyers. You know, it's just hard to do. And that has impacts into like how long it would take you to get all that sorted out and straightened around. And it's not that it can't be done, it's just that nobody in the service particularly likes to do it, and it's, you know, a complication. And then development impacts, pretty self-explanatory. The buildings either exist, or you have to build a new building on an impacted site, or you're doing a new building in a natural area in the case of F&G. Mm-hmm. Cost here. The actual costs are described in the alternative section. They range from the cheapest one, Damariscotta, for retrofitting that building and putting in the displays or exhibits, to the next least expensive one would be Lincolnville. The next cheapest one would be Rockland. And then the Old County Road and Sears Island are about equal because you have to build about the same amount of stuff. And the Sears Port site is the most expensive because you have to throw in that extra million for land. Mm. And school children within 15 miles, Rockland has the largest population there. And the other ones are pretty comparable. Sears Island has the fewest school children within 15 miles. And the average daily number of cars, Sears Island and Sears Port both have the highest numbers. And Rockland, Lincolnville are middling, and Old County Road and Damariscotta, because they're on Old County Road's a side road and Damariscotta is business route one, so they lose a lot because of the bypass. And then the discussion of ranking results on page 22, that just goes through them from top ranked down and just kind of gives what we see as the good things and the bad things. I tried to, you know, just sort of sum up the strengths and weaknesses of each site that would sum up, you know, how their rankings did. So if you only read two pages in the document, that's probably the executive summary right there. And then I go on and talk about economic impacts to tax revenue. That's a little bit complicated, probably a little hard to understand. We do payment in, it's like payment in lieu of taxes, where obviously we don't pay real estate taxes where we own land, but there is a refuge revenue sharing program. Kind of complicated how we figure that out, but it's based on the appraised value of the property, not the assessed value. Mm-hmm. So the market value of the property, we reappraise it every 5 years, and then we apply a formula to that. And what I've done is, you know, and it's more complicated than that because we usually don't have enough money to pay everybody, and Congress doesn't sometimes, they can boost it if they want, but they don't usually boost it to 100% of what it should be. So typically we only give half of what we should be giving, half or less. So it's kind of, in these cases, sometimes on undeveloped land there are cases where the town actually gets more, but generally not. And in these cases, the town's get like 20%, basically. Now, in the two that, there are two where it doesn't matter, and that those are the two we don't own in fee. Damer Scott is already owned by a nonprofit. They don't pay taxes. So Damer Scott has already lost the tax base on that property. And the DOT, Maine DOT that owns Sears Island, also doesn't pay taxes. So in that case, since we wouldn't own it, we wouldn't pay anything. Those two would stay the same. The other ones would lose some income on the tax rolls. And however, you have to, the on the positive economic side is the fact that we'd be bringing an estimated 22,000 visitors, you know, to whichever town it ends up in. We wouldn't be bringing 22,000 visitors. 22,000 visitors would be spending more time, you know, maybe coming off the, you know, that's more a fair way to, more fair way to say it. I think, however, that being said, that there are very few seabird conservation centers in the world. There's just, I think, four or five. There's one in Japan, one in New Zealand, one in Newfoundland, one in Alaska. So there's very none in the lower 48. You know, and you know how many people come to Maine to look at puffins. And none of those people know that we produce those for them. And they don't even know about razorbills, you know. How cool is that? Razorbills are very cool. But there would be some impact in a positive way of this center, having people either come specially to see it or adding another half day to their stay, whatever that might be. And I am no economist, but I used an economic analysis that was done for Sears Island. You know, and that report estimated 22,000 visitors a year, $1.7 million of sales impact, you know, which is kind of the direct and indirect multiplying kind of funding. So even though they're losing out on taxes, we would hope that we would bring more to the community than we take. And another point there is we, you know, don't pay taxes, but we also don't use the school systems, you know, et cetera. And that's about it to lead you through the document. There's also a chapter on consultation coordination with others that shows you some of the meetings that we had, talking to people, you know, how we came up with these sites, and then some of the literature cited. And as I mentioned in the appendix, there's the goals and objectives that are about public use. And then I noticed I got, on my copy anyway, I stapled the last one backwards. I hope yours are better. Appendix B, which is just a internal kind of, has to do with endangered species. So we're cleared. We don't think we're going to do anything to any endangered species because we don't think any exist on any of the sites. So now I'll open it for questions.